feared the foreign-made drug sodium thiopental could cause Landrigan serious pain and suffering, a violation of the U.S. Constitution. However, the U.S. Supreme Court cleared the way for the execution. Landrigan was sentenced to death in 1990 for the strangulation and stabbing death of Chester Dyer. The execution was the first in Arizona since 2007. For NPR News, I'm Jillian Ferris Cole in Flagstaff.
An Ohio woman convicted in a major corporate fraud case is back in federal custody after spending 2 years on the run. The FBI says Rebecca Parrott was arrested in Mexico yesterday and is being turned over to U.S. authorities. In early 2008, Parrott was convicted in a nearly $2 billion fraud scheme involving a healthcare financing company. After she fled, Parrott was sentenced in absentia to 25 years in prison. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
Monday through Friday at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580. Now that our on-air drive is over, WILL would like to say a big thank you to the more than 1,000 listeners who contributed over $171,000 in membership support. Your generous contributions truly make a difference.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. Many Americans, might even say most Americans, shared in the benefits of the immediate post-war boom in the American economy. But things really began to change in this country in the late 1970s. And since that time, the wealthiest Americans have become richer, and the rest of America has fallen farther and further behind. Our guest for this hour, political scientist Paul Pearson, says that there have been many different explanations that have been offered for this increasing inequality in this country. But he says that the guilty party here is American politics. This morning, we'll be talking with Paul Pearson about a book that he co-authored that's just recently come out. The title of the book is Winner Take All Politics. The subtitle, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Paul Pearson is the John Gross Professor of Political Science at University of California at Berkeley. His co-author on the book, by the way, is Jacob Hacker. He's Professor of Political Science at Yale. Now, as we talk with Paul Pearson about some of the ideas that you'll find in the book, questions certainly are welcome. We'd like to get people into the conversation. We just hope that people will be on target with the topic and that they'll try to be brief, just so we can get in as many different people as would like to call. So if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So if it's long distance, use that one. And, of course, you can send your thoughts along to by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Any point here, questions, comments are certainly welcome. And Professor Pearson, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Just a couple of things just right off the top. One of the things that really strikes me, and I'm sure it strikes a lot of people, is that we have been talking about, I guess that means journalists and policy people and political science professors and politicians and social activists. You know, people have been talking about rising income inequality for some time now. But it seems like it just doesn't have the kind of impact that you think that it should.
You mean impact on the politics?
Or even in terms of it being something really that is on a lot of people's minds. As an issue, it just doesn't have the impact that you think that it should. And maybe ultimately we are talking about politics.
Well, I think it is a kind of, you know, part of the problem is that it's a very slow-moving, creeping trend which isn't going to generate headlines. I think one thing about many elements of the news media, of course, is that they like stories about disasters or, you know, events that take place on a particular day. And so you don't get headlines to say, guess what, inequality is a little higher today than it was yesterday. So I think it is often hard for us to fully focus on these kinds of long-term trends, even when they're very, very pronounced. At the same time, though, I think there, in just the last year or two, my sense is that there is more awareness, growing awareness, of how serious this problem is. And I think, and maybe this is connected to the huge economic problems that we've been going through, I think people are starting to get a better sense of what we say is that Jacob and I in this book say is the really distinctive feature of this rising inequality, which is that it is winner-take-all, how concentrated the gains have been in a very, very small group. It's not as if, you know, sort of the upper middle class is pulling away from the lower middle class. It's really the top 1% of Americans who are pulling away from everyone else.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to make, and that sometimes maybe when we talk about these issues, people get snowed under with numbers. But as you point out here, that we're really talking about when you ask, well, who has done really well over the last several decades? It's the top of the top. I mean, it's not only the richest 1%. But it's a tiny slice of the richest 1%.
Yes, it's one of those things where, you know, every time you recalibrate the microscope to look at a smaller slice of things, you see more and more of the action. So you're absolutely right. The top 1% has done better than everybody else, but the top 10th of 1% has done much better than the top 1%, and the top 100th of 1%. Has done, even better than the rest of the people in the top 10th of 1%. Even just in the last couple of years, new data just came out from the Social Security Administration, which showed that in 2009, so in the middle of this really deep recession that we're having, the income share of those making the very, very top incomes, people making over $50 million a year, the number of people making over $50 million a year tripled in 2009. Mm-hmm. So yes, the gains have been extremely concentrated.
And it's not, I suppose, that people who don't make that kind of money would say, well, you know, it's not that there's been no improvement in their standard of living. It's maybe if you discount the last couple of years. But I think it's still also the case that if you look at the gains that were made by almost everybody, you know, look at 90% of the American population, look at what gains they've managed to make, that's still less than those people at the very top.
Right, right. If you look at all the growth in income in the United States since 1979, so not just in the recent economic downturn, but going all the way back to the late 1970s, the income gains that have gone to the top 1% are greater than the income gains that have gone to the bottom 90% of the population. So that's the gains that have gone to the top 10th of 1%, so, you know, just one out of every 1,000 households over that period are greater than the gains that went to the bottom 60% of Americans. So hopefully over the course of this hour, we'll get a chance to talk about why Americans should care, why middle-class Americans might want to care about what's happening at the very top, because I think there are very good reasons to care about it. But the first point to make is that the nature of this rising inequality takes this very particular form, which is that the gains are very concentrated at the top.
One other sort of big point that I think you make, and it's worth making, is that the way that we do talk about this, and particularly the way that people in Washington talk about this income inequality, that they have a way, and, you know, perhaps also economists talk like this, other people talk like this, they have a way of talking about it as if, well, it's really nobody's fault. You know, it's just something that happened, and it has to do with economic forces. And they talk about it as if there was a certain kind of inevitability about it. You really say, you and Professor Hacker say, no, that's not true at all.
That's absolutely right, David. I think that much of the discussion, both in Washington and in the economics profession, we quote the Treasury Secretary under George W. Bush, Paulson, as saying, you know, rising inequality is just a fact of life, and it's no good blaming any political party. And you might understand why he wouldn't have wanted any political party to be blamed, but I think he really, in this case, was reflecting the conventional wisdom, which was to say, this is a result of forces beyond our control. It's a result of changing technology. It's a result of the globalization of the economy. All of this has made education more important, and so it's created a big gap between those with education and those who don't have education. Mm-hmm. And of course, if it's inevitable, you know, often the argument follows from that, well, there's not really very much we can do about it. Maybe we can improve people's education a little bit, but we're just going to have to get used to living with higher levels of inequality. And a central argument of the book is that this is just not correct, that this is inevitable. I mean, we're not arguing that globalization doesn't matter and that technological change doesn't matter, but many, many affluent democracies have experienced those same forces. Many other affluent democracies are actually more exposed to global trade than the United States is, and yet they haven't seen the same kind of skyrocketing top-end inequality that the United States has experienced. And it's also just not the case that the gap that has opened up is one between the educated and the less educated. And if you think about it for a second, if it's really the top 1% that is seeing these big economic gains, well, that means that there are a lot of very educated people who are on the losing side of this shift. You know, there are 30% of Americans or more have college degrees. 10% of Americans have advanced degrees, you know, beyond college, and yet most of those people are on the outside looking in when it comes to these kinds of changes. So we really, I think, that it's important to think seriously about the role of government and the role of public policy in bringing about these changes, and we argue in the book that government has made a huge contribution to rising inequality.
Well, why is it, though, it's just unacknowledged, and why is it that you have to actually have to make a point of saying, that's what the whole book is really about, have to make a point of saying, yes, in fact, we're not talking about obscure forces that are here that are beyond anybody's control. What we're talking about is government policy, either things, and also I think you make some important distinctions here, that it's not just what government does. Sometimes it is what government does not do. But one way or another, it's intentional. Why is it that you actually have to make the point that that is the case?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons for that, and then maybe I could start sketching out a little bit of how we do try to make the case. I mean, obviously, people who are benefiting from these kinds of changes, and we argue in the book that these groups are increasingly powerful in American society and in American politics, they have strong incentives to make arguments that say, you know, this is inevitable. You know, it's not something that's being done to the American middle class. It's just something that's happening, and there's no point in complaining about it. And I also think, frankly, that a lot of the discussion has been dominated by economists who have a strong tendency to not pay much attention to politics and policy and see markets as sort of naturally generating certain kinds of results. And one of the main arguments we make in the book is that government policy is very, very actively involved in shaping the nature of markets. It's not as if the economy is some kind of state of nature that comes into being on its own before you have government playing a role. Government plays a huge role in shaping the nature of the economy and the way that it distributes rewards. And I think we started this book before the financial crisis, started working on it before the financial crisis, but it's a lot easier to see the point that we're making here in the wake of the financial crisis. The political process, which helped to drive financial deregulation, a bipartisan political process, I might add, during the 1980s and 1990s and early part of 2000s, that had a huge effect on generating these massive bubbles and massive levels of speculation and unregulated activities of finance that contributed both to growing inequality, especially top-end inequality, and eventually to the economic catastrophe that we've experienced over the last few years. So the idea that that's something that just happened naturally and the government didn't have anything to do with it, I think is a much harder argument to make now than it might have been a few years ago. And we suggest in the book that that's just one of a number of examples. The decline of unions is another, which we think has been quite important in weakening the role of the middle class and the voice of the middle class in Washington, is something that was in part brought about by government policies and also by, as you were suggesting in your question, by the kind of studious effort of government not to do anything as the economic world changed. So a lot of the role of Washington, you know, sometimes it's active policymaking. In some cases, it's just Washington sitting on his hands while aspects of the economic world change.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Paul Pearson. He's professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley. He is the co-author, along with Jacob Hacker, who is professor of political science at Yale University. They are together the authors of the recent book, Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. That's the subtitle. It's published by Simon & Schuster. It's out in the bookstore now, in bookstores now, if you want to read it. And questions welcome. We're getting some people here lined up. Again, we'd like to get as many people as possible, and folks will help us by trying to keep their questions and comments brief, but certainly you're welcome to call 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk at illinois.edu. We have a couple people here. We'll start us off with someone in Champaign, I believe, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
I'm very excited to read your book. It sounds like you take a very, from my perspective, good take on what's happened over the last three decades in terms of essentially the various conditions for the rising gulf between the wealthy and those below the very wealthy. And one thing I just wanted to, a couple of things I wanted to note, and I know that you're aware of this, but you know, I'm a fan of Paul Krugman's op-ed and blog and so forth. And, you know, Krugman has noted that even with this you know, so-called potential extension of the Bush tax cuts, that everyone, you know, talks about $100,000 for every millionaire. What they don't mention is that roughly one-fourth of 1% of the population, it's 120,000 people, over a 10-year period, if this is extended, they will receive $3 million per person, according to Krugman. And he's checked his numbers repeatedly and noted this in his blog and on the op-ed. No one makes news of this, that 120,000 Americans each will receive individually $3 million. This is unbelievable, right? Another aspect that I noted that I researched myself just to make sure by looking at the government website for the IRS, that our levels of highest taxation were at 91 to 94% for the entire period, 1938 to 63. Kennedy lowered them to 70, and then, of course, in the Reagan lowered them to roughly, I think it was 35% initially, came down to 28 by the end of the Reagan era, and now we're back at around 35%. And this has to be directly related to the problems that have occurred, and Krugman has pointed this out repeatedly, that our highest growth was at the period where we had very high taxation, and we've created taxes as a discourse of taxes as taboo, We all know that Walter Mondale said he would raise taxes, and we saw how he did in the presidential election in 84. And, of course, Reagan was pivotal in destroying the unions during the 1980s. So I do think there is something fundamentally partisan about this originally, though, of course, Clinton and others have cooperated in the process.
Well, I think you're making a great point, and particularly in focusing on the tax issue. And let me just say a couple of things about that, because this is obviously the most visible, immediate way in which government can make a difference in the distribution of income. There are a lot of others that we talked about, and I don't think we should focus just on the way that government taxes and spends, because that's too narrow a way to think about it. But taxes and changes in tax policy have mattered a lot. And the changes actually start in the late 1970s, which to us is kind of a revealing fact, that it's when you have a Democratic Congress and a Democrat in the White House that you start to see the big cuts in capital gains and initial cuts in income taxes for those at the very top end. And so I hope we can get a little further in the next few minutes into thinking about what was going on in American politics that started to produce this change, even at a time when you did have Democrats in control in Washington. People often talk about what the very top rates looked like. Yes, it's true that you had a marginal rates approaching 90%. Of course, most people had ways of getting around that, so nobody, I think, actually ended up paying those kinds of rates. But it is absolutely true, as we point out in the book, that if you go back to, say, the 1960s and early 1970s, that people in the top 1%, and especially in the top, say, 10th of 1% or 100th of 1%, they paid much, much higher rates of real taxes than they do now. There's been a steady, steady stream of cuts that have brought, you know, the true tax rate for people at the very top down from about 60% to 30% or even lower. In the case of hedge fund managers, many of them are paying, who are making the most fabulous salaries. Many of them are having those salaries taxed at the capital gains rate of 15%, which is really astonishing. So it is absolutely right that the changes in tax policy have been hugely beneficial for those at the very top. Thank you.
Well, I thank you for the comment. Here, you make a lot of really important and interesting points, but let me ask you about one in particular. I think that certainly it is true that we in the news media were just obsessed with elections. There is so much coverage devoted to elections and campaigns, but you say that really we should be paying a lot more attention to what happens in between the elections. The policy debates and how policy gets set, that's, as far as the news media is concerned, that's kind of boring. People don't pay attention to that. But what you have argued is that now over the last several decades, organized groups that have particular interests have become very important in American politics. And the money that they spend on elections, but even more the money they spend on lobbying, has become very important. And they have been very effective in moving government in the direction that they want. And again, to talk about, to repeat something we've said before, that it's not just always getting the government to do something. Sometimes it's getting the government not to do something.
Right.
And that's really a central sort of argument and description that is really here in this book.
I think, Dave, you really hit on what we think is the fundamental point that we want to make about American politics, because if you take a step back and think about the rise of this winner-take-all economy and the idea that government has really contributed to this, it immediately raises a huge puzzle, which is, how can this happen in a democracy? We're all aware of some of the failings of the purity of our electoral system, but still, it's a system where you've got to get a majority to win an election. And if the economy is really trending in directions that are so damaging, why isn't there a political response to that? That's, I think, a fundamental puzzle that we try to try to clear up and solve in the book. And as you say, our answer, our fundamental answer, is that analysts tend to really underestimate the role of organizations in politics. Even though we spend a lot of time talking in general terms about special interests, we still act as if elections are what we call the politics of electoral spectacle, that is really the centerpiece, the heart of politics. And it's not that elections don't matter. They matter a lot. We're going to have an election next Tuesday, and it's going to matter a lot. But organizations, as you say, the powerful organizations, especially business groups and other groups where the well-to-do have a big advantage, they spend much more money on lobbying than they do on election campaigns. And they know that what's critical for them is what actually happens in Washington, not what the politicians say, but what they do, or as you know, what they sometimes don't do. And so, our basic solution to the puzzle of how you created a winner-take-all economy is that came through what we call winner-take-all politics, and that this really emerges out of a profound shift in the balance of organized power in American society that begins in the mid to late 1970s. That's why you start to see these big tax cuts for the well-to-do in the late 1970s, along with a lot of other significant changes. Business mobilizes on an unprecedented scale beginning in the mid-1970s. And at the same time, unions are going into decline. And that process has basically continued through the three decades that have followed. And it has had a huge effect on the way that Washington works and who it works for. It's affected both political parties, although in different ways. And one thing that we stress in the book is we spend a lot of time talking about the Republicans and the Democrats, and we argue that both parties were affected by this organizational change, but they're not identical. The two parties are actually in some ways more different from each other than they used to be, but they both in different ways have contributed to the rise of the winner-take-all economy.
All right. We are at a midpoint already here. We have some callers again that can help us by being brief. We'd like to get in as many as we can. We'll start in with Champaign County, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. I was just dismayed to hear that the referendum on the millionaires' tax out in Washington State seems to be failing, which is really a shame because it would at least short-circuit the lobbying and the political establishment on both sides that would allow for some more equity to be in the tax system. But I wanted you to address social mobility and what many people call, I guess, the myth of social mobility. It seems to me I heard a discussion about this subject, and the claim was made that in the OECD countries, so there's like 8 or 9 countries that have a higher index of social mobility than people changing quintiles or at least going up the ladder. I heard a apparatchik from one of the Heritage or one of the think tanks on the right saying that, that's obscured because they just don't have as much of a range of wealth. So I don't know if there's any sounds specious to me, but I wanted you to take that apart. The other thing I wanted you to address, and maybe you addressed it in the book, but there was recently I guess it was a Pew study of the misapprehension of income distribution and wealth distribution in this country, and it even showed that economists don't know how bad the distribution is. You're probably familiar with this study, so you'll probably address it better than I can in a moment. But the astonishing thing that I found was when they gave a variety of income distributions and people were choosing to pick what they thought was a good income distribution, they were given the income distribution of Sweden without being told it was Sweden, and that even 93% of Republicans picked that as their favorite, their most appropriate income distribution. I just think that there's, well, I don't know, psychological terms, cognitive dissonance, or something seemed necessary to be employed to do this. But it's just, to me, it's shocking that economists even don't understand what the income distribution in this country is.
All right. Let's give the guests a chance to make some comments.
I think they're both very good points. We actually discuss both of them in the book. It is true that the American record, at least in the modern period, on social mobility is not very impressive. There is a lot of mythology about how much mobility there is, and there is actually less than there is in many of the countries of Europe that we think of as being more hidebound and lacking that kind of mobility. And just logically, to the extent that income becomes concentrated in very, very small circles, that means essentially by definition, fewer and fewer Americans are going to have a chance of reaching the point where the big economic rewards are concentrated. So social mobility has for a long time been more limited in the U.S. than I think most people realize, and it's bound to be diminished. Its value diminished in a context where the gains have become so concentrated. We use the metaphor of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. The magic ticket, golden ticket. When all the rewards are concentrated in just a handful of tickets, most people, no matter how diligently they work, are not going to participate in that. The point about people's knowledge of inequality, I think this is quite right, and we discuss it in the book. It turns out that Americans differ from folks in other affluent democracies less in their views about what income distribution ought to look like in the society than actually in their awareness of how skewed incomes have become. So it turns out there's an interesting survey that basically asked people to estimate how much people make in different professions and in the United States. And it turns out that if you ask people about the jobs of people who are in fairly close social proximity to them, like a teacher or even a doctor, they can do a pretty good job of estimating that. But when it comes to estimating the salaries of CEOs, they give, median estimate was $500,000 a year, which is just a spectacular undercount of what CEOs of major corporations are being paid. So I think this is true, that it's something that Americans don't talk about as much or not as informed about, though again, I think the polls suggest that people are gradually becoming more aware. People are much more likely today than they were a generation ago to describe the United States as a country divided between haves and have-nots.
We are past our midpoint here. We're starting to get into our last maybe 15 minutes on the program. Our guest is Paul Pearson. He is professor of political science at University of California, Berkeley. He's the co-author, along with Jacob Hacker, who teaches political science at Yale. They're the two authors of the recent book, Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We'll go on and talk next with someone in Effingham, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you, David. A couple of questions short for your guest. I wonder, do you understand the transition from tribalism to feudalism?
I'm not sure I understand what the relevance of the question is.
Because that is a social progression.
Maybe we're really. Well, it would help us if you give us something a little bit more concrete to work with, I think.
Well, the very subject matter of what's being talked about indicates the progression of the haves and the have-nots, just as you have said. The same applied from tribalism to feudalism, and feudalism fell victim to capitalism, and now capitalism seemingly to me is reaching its synthesis. Would you have any comment, or did I make any sense again?
Well, okay, now I see what you're getting at. And I guess my reaction would be to stress that what's happening in the United States is really distinctive. And in some ways, so I don't actually think it's the nature of capitalism per se to produce these kinds of effects. Something has happened that's particular to the United States. And because, again, you can look at, there has been some increase in inequality in most affluent democracies that have, you know, thriving capitalist economies, you know, world-class corporations. There's been some increase in inequality in most of these countries, but far less than there's been in the United States, and it's been far less concentrated at the very, very top of the income distribution. You know, another way to think about that, which is a way that we described in the book, is that, you know, the United States used to be a sort of recognizable member of the family of affluent democracies that the kind of system that we had in the mid part of this century, in which there was inequality, but a rising tide was lifting at least most boats, that everybody's income was moving up together, a world that we describe as broadland in the book. But we've now begun this transit to a world that you can call Richistan, in which the gains are much more concentrated. And most other affluent democracies aren't making that journey. We've been drifting away from that cluster of affluent democracies towards a different cluster, a cluster of economic oligarchies, countries like Mexico and Brazil or Russia, which have income distributions that look, you know, with very, very concentrated gains at the top, that look more like what we're starting to experience in the United States. So I don't see this as something that is some inevitable characteristic of a market-based economy. I see it as something that is is distinctive to the American experience over the last 30 years.
Well, what just here, I don't want to end up at the very end of the show asking the question, what could change or what should change, and end up without having time to do that, because that often happens. Here, this would be a good point for me to ask the question, well, if indeed this is not inevitable, what would we have to do? How would we have to change our politics?
Okay, so that's a great question. It's obviously a question on everyone's mind. And the first thing to say, people often say, well, this book is depressing and pessimistic, but we, Jacob and I, actually think of it as being an optimistic book compared with the way that many people talk about rising inequality, because we are arguing that it's not inevitable, that it's something that has resulted from human activity, and that could be controlled and moderated or reversed by human activity working through politics. So it's not, you can see many examples of this in Washington. There are policies that would push back hard against the winner-take-all economy. Think about changes in the tax system, for example, that would really matter, or really bringing financial markets under control, for example, or putting some reasonable restrictions on the ability of executives essentially to work with pliant boards to rig their own system of compensation. There are a lot of things that you could potentially challenge through public policy. The difficulty is working through the politics. You know, again, I think our book points to the way to approach that, which is that until there is significant organized efforts on economic issues that relate to the middle class, it's going to be difficult to put that kind of pressure on Washington. And now, we think that unions can be a part of that, and that Americans need to realize that unions, which have often been vilified over the last few decades, that unions play a crucial role not just for their members, but for providing a political voice for middle class or, you know, non-privileged economic interests, that's got to be an important part of the story. And also that there have to be, you know, strenuous efforts to make people more aware of what's been going on and the fact that it's something that's potentially under our control.
Mm. It just, I'm sure some people would just raise the question of resources here and would say that those, again, going back to your idea about just how important organizations have become over the last few decades, they'd say, well, you know, look at the organizations that are representing the interest of business and look at the organizations that are representing the interest of workers and who has the more resources. Well, the fact of the matter is that the Chamber of Commerce has a whole lot more money to put behind this than do unions.
Well, that's absolutely right. And it's, you know, especially when you realize that the Chamber is just one of many participants on that side. You know, there is an incredible organizational imbalance, and it is going to be a huge challenge to push back against it. I do think that there are reasons to think that there is potential for that. I think the development of the Internet, for example, and the opportunities that it's created for relatively diffuse interests, for scattered interests to come together in pursuit of a common cause is an important development. You know, the Obama campaign is an example of that. And you know, I'm glad that we've focused on the big picture and the long-term story here, but we spend a significant amount of time in the book talking about the challenges that the Obama administration has faced. And and you know, one thing that we argue is that there is a huge difference with respect to these issues between a Bush administration and an Obama administration. But the Obama administration has been hugely challenged by the imbalances of these organizational resources. So we probably would give the Obama administration higher grades than some people would during the first 2 years, because we're struck by how steep the hill is that they've been trying to climb. You know, one other point when we're talking about political reform that has to be a part of this conversation is what's happened to the United States Senate and the extent to which it is now possible for 40 senators to stop almost all legislation, which historically has not been the case. People and the media often treats the filibuster as almost a constitutional feature of American politics, but the truth is it's not. It's simply a rule that the Senate created, and it used to be that filibusters were very rare. And now the Republicans filibuster everything, which combined with the ability of organized groups to put pressure on those swing senators, makes it very, very difficult for Washington to legislate on behalf of the middle class. You know, we see that, for example, in the recent discussion about taxes that one of the callers mentioned before. And there are many other examples as well. So political reform has to be at the top of the agenda for people who care about these issues. And I would say reform of the Senate should be at the top of anyone's list of political reforms.
All right. We have about 10 minutes, less than 10 minutes left. Some other callers will go next. Belgium, line 3. Hello.
Hello. And since we're near at the end, I'd like to point out that this really isn't the first time this has happened. If we look back to the 1870s, the exact same thing happened there. The robber barons gained control of the emerging industrial technology at the time. They had control of Congress, and they took things to go in their own directions and got great things. The Transcontinental Railroad that started out there where you guys were at definitely had influences in Congress that made this happen. And if we look at what happened in the past, I think we may very well see what's going to happen in the future.
I think this is a really excellent point. Jacob and I were doing research on this book, we were increasingly struck by the parallels between the current period, the period of drift of the last 30 or 40 years, and the experience of the last part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. And the challenge that progressives faced was in many ways very similar, as the caller said, very similar to the challenges of today. You had a very dynamic economy that was bringing about wrenching social and economic change. but also generating huge concentrations of economic resources. And those economic resources were then being translated into political control, so that Washington became essentially captured by these groups. And if one thinks about, we call it the politics of renewal in the book, a long struggle from the early 1900s through the New Deal was an attempt essentially to bring some kind of political oversight over this over these economic changes, which had produced, you know, incredible new flows of wealth, but also all sorts of social dysfunction, and with the gains being incredibly concentrated. So you get in the early 1900s, you have, you know, Teddy Roosevelt declaring that the supreme political task of our day is to drive the special interests out of our public life. You know, 20 years later, FDR arguing that political equality was meaningless in the face of economic inequality. Very much those same kinds of problems, I think, same kinds of challenges resonate today.
All right, let's try to get at least one other caller. I want to thank the last. We'll go next to Normal, line one. Hello.
Hello, great. Hey, thanks for providing hope. I think it's a very old, ancient struggle, because I think we have indications the Egyptian masters were mean to their Jewish slaves. So I think this is an old, ancient. But yeah, you guys said earlier that inequality was like a low interest impact topic, whereas, like, you know, Condit's sex scandals get maximum airplay. Made me all think of a book I read a long time ago called Community Power Structure. Something about decision makers, how decisions are made. Community Power Structure by Lloyd Hunter, published in 1953. Mm-hmm. And there he just gives you a straight up example, because he interviews people anonymously. He changes the names and all that. He claims it's all very factual, but there he's got an industry elite captain who tells you straight up that they control the media. They control the definitions of what is good or bad. They are able to, through their, and because they sit on the boards of directors, so like they were fighting against price fixing at the time, trying to convince society it was bad. And they had this one reporter that was pro price fixing. Well, they were able to get him to do sports and to change his career. But I was reading just The Onion the other day, and it said that the American people need to hire lobbyists. And that's the thing, is that the wealthy, they're not attached to labor the way that the masses are, and they can hang out in D.C. day after day and not have to worry about working, showing up at a job to get that paycheck. So they can become buddies and friends and develop very powerful psychological relationships with the power holders. And the only thing I'm sitting here thinking about lobbying, I heard, too, that there's been lobby companies that have been staffed with prostitutes. And I say, if that is the case, I don't know how anybody could resist. Day after day, if something like that came to my office, I'd be a shameful, disrespectful person. And then
I've got to jump in here just to give the guest a chance to make some comments, because we're really coming down to maybe having just a couple of minutes left.
Well, there's a fair amount there that I agree with. I mean, I do think, as you say, it's an old story, but it's it's not something that is inevitable. I mean, this society was not so heavily skewed towards the top 30 years ago. Things looked very different then than they do now, and they look different in other countries. Things in Canada don't look the same as they do here with respect to these issues, even though, you know, Canada has a very successful competitive economy, market-based economy like ours, but they haven't seen they've seen some increase in inequality, but it's not as pronounced as it is here. So there is a distinctively American story. I do think, I see it less as a sort of organized conspiracy with a small number of people than just, because I don't think anybody, I think, you know, Washington is a fairly chaotic place. There are a lot of people moving in different directions there. But the point is, as the caller was saying, that certain voices are a lot louder than others. People have the resources to hire lobbyists and to really monitor what is happening in Washington and find ways to block or diffuse things that they don't want, and to seize opportunities when they're available. That's the climate that we need to focus on changing.
We have about 2 minutes. One last thing, and actually we've touched on it a couple of times. Next week, we're going to have election. It looks like Republicans will take the House. We don't know about the Senate. The White House will continue to be held by a Democrat. Some people would say, well, you know, maybe that's not such a bad thing. They would say, yes, that's a recipe for gridlock. But if there's gridlock, at least they're not going to do any. They're not going to do anything counterproductive. They're not going to do anything bad. And this comes back again to your argument that says, well, no, that's a mistake, thinking that that if nothing happens, that's good.
So actually, Jacob and I have a piece in the most recent issue of the American Prospect on this called The Stalemate State, if your listeners are interested, that talks about what the likely effects of gridlock will be. Mm-hmm. And yes, our point would be that if government can't do anything, that's not neutral, right? That advantages those who gain when markets are basically allowed to operate without any kind of oversight, without any kind of contribution of responsiveness to ordinary Americans. I think also in thinking about the elections, some people are going to read what happens on Tuesday as a sign that, people are swinging back to the Republicans. They're swinging back to support for deregulation and tax cuts. And I think that would be a huge misreading of what those elections are going to show. There's 10% unemployment, and people are extremely frustrated. And they are extremely disappointed with Washington. And given what I've said over the last hour or so, I can completely understand why people are frustrated with it. But there is no sign in polling data that suggests that people are embracing the Republican agenda. More Americans, by a large margin, still blame Bush for the economic crisis rather than Obama. Congressional Republicans and their agenda is extremely unpopular in polls. People, I think, are going to be voting to express their frustration both with an economy that is performing miserably and with a political system that seems dysfunctional and is not producing results for the middle class. So on the one hand, I can completely understand why people are reacting that way. On the other hand, I think the people who are going to be gaining political power are almost certain to make the problems worse rather than better.
And just real quick, will there be a fundamental change in the direction or the priorities of the Democratic Party?
Well, it'll be interesting to watch to see what happens. You're going to see a chastened, smaller party for sure. And I think, the most likely result is just that you're going to have gridlock and almost no legislation and very intense fighting over the next 2 years. Much of the confrontation. Frankly, I think the congressional leadership. The Democratic congressional leadership is likely to be fairly marginalized, and the real struggle is going to be, assuming the Republicans gain control of the House, which I think is likely, that the real struggle is going to be between the Obama administration, how it decides to respond to these developments, and a newly empowered Republicans.
Our guest, Paul Pearson, is professor of political science at University of California, Berkeley. He's the co-author with Jacob Hacker, who teaches political science at Yale, of the book Winner Take All Politics, published by Simon & Schuster. It's just out. Professor Pearson, thanks very much.
Really my pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Dave.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe offers versatile catering options for breakfast meetings, working lunches, or afternoon receptions. Services include a wide selection of food and beverages suited to any budget. More information is available online or at 244-2233. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
That's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. In Kansas City, December wheat is trading at 747, up 8.5. March, 763.5, up 9.5. December wheat in Chicago, 699.5, up 7.5. March, 738.25, up 7.25. December corn, 571.5, up 1.5. March, 584.5, up 1.5. May, 590.5, up 1.5. July, 594, unchanged. November soybeans, 12.16¾, down 2¼. January, 12.28¼, down 2½. March, 12.34¼, down 3½. May, 12.36, down 2¾. July, 12.38¾, down 4¾. December meal, 3.33.80, down 1.70. December oil, 49.37, down 16. October live cattle, $100.50, down 35. December, 99.77½, down 32.5. October feeder cattle, 111.35, up 5. November, 112 even, up 15. December lean hog, 67.55.